Well, I'd just like to add my welcome to Aaron's from earlier. I'd like to thank you all for being here. It's a great treat to screen the film, but also, of course, to have Kathleen Cleaver with us. It's a great honor to have her with us. Aside from everything else, she's this amazing living archive of the period that you just saw depicted, and since then as well. And we also have an additional special guest who will join us after Kathleen and I talk for a little while, Aristides Baltas, who's a member of the Greek Parliament, one of the members of the Central Committee of the Coalition for the Radical Left, the government in Greece right now, and a former Minister of Culture and Education for the current government. But he'll join us later. But I wanted to begin the discussion with Kathleen. And as Aaron said, we'll talk for a little while ourselves, and then we'll invite Aristides to join us, and then we'll open it up for all of you. I think one of the things that struck me in watching the film again is just how resonant and contemporary it seems in terms of the things that it's talking about, even today and perhaps especially today, when the United States is again experiencing all kinds of racial oppression. And it's perhaps necessary again in this context and in the present moment to recognize that the United States has often harbored and even depended upon a violation of the spirit of democracy. And this violation, of course, has been called racism. So I think that one of the things that's also central to the experience of racism is the politics of its denial. And this is something that occurs even when in the present we see the rise of white racial nationalist movements and increasingly legible movements. And this is why I think that our discussion with Kathleen tonight is going to be so valuable. And I thought that just as a beginning, Kathleen, that because I think everybody's here for you in some way, also for the film, is that maybe you could, you know, the film gives some of this, but I think that maybe you could say a few words about your perception of the formation of the Black Panthers in 66, and also what moved you to join the Black Panthers. What was so appealing about them? Because you were working with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. You left that committee to join the Black Panthers. And I just wonder if you could say a few words about the appeal for you of the Black Panther Party.
Well, let me say something about how the Black Panther Party that I joined in California came into existence. There was already a Black Panther Party that I was in an organization called Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. The chairman at that time was Stokely Carmichael, a very handsome man you saw in this documentary. I wanted to be in this movement. It was very, very exciting. They had done so many demonstrations. The most appealing thing to me, there was a woman named Ruby Doris Robinson, who was one of the leaders, and she was in charge of something in Mississippi called the Sojourner Truth Motor Fleet, which were the cars that the civil rights workers in Mississippi used. And it was very important because you had to get out. You had to get away. And so the cars, so I saw a photograph of her in Ebony magazine, and she had on a white shirt, she had an afro, and she had sort of a sound system where she could call cars, and she just looked so powerful and so important. I was totally impressed. I wanted to be like her. And I didn't realize she was very petite, and by the time I got into the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, she had actually become ill and passed away. And so she was like my inspiration. But then I met many more inspiring people. These were college students, activists. One of the most important members of the organization never went to college. His name was Willie Ricks. He was from Tennessee. And we would have all these activities in Mississippi and various places. And Willie Ricks never, ever got arrested. Why? Because he'd come to the demonstration, he'd wear his overalls, he'd wear his, you know, straw hat. He'd look just like somebody in the community. They never thought he was one of the radicals there. And so it was the most exciting time to be with young people, college students, black kids, white kids, who wanted to change the world and actually were risking their lives to do it. So that was the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. The Black Panther Party was based in California. And I met one of their leaders. He came to a conference we held in Tennessee. And this conference was about a black history, and we invited all these famous writers and so-and-so who was supposed to come. And there was a snowfall in the East Coast, and none of them could get on an airplane. So the only person who actually came to our conference in Nashville was this man from California, who was a writer named Eldridge Cleaver. And I'd heard about it, but I didn't know anything about him. And he walks into the building where we're having our meeting, and he was so tall, he was as tall as the door frame. What I didn't know is that he's a man who had been in prison for 9 years, and he'd been out for 3 months. So he was still sort of, like he stood at the door. This is what you do in prison. You don't go anywhere until they tell you it's okay. So he came in and stood at the door. And he was waiting for someone to tell him to come in. And so he said, when he met me there, he said it was love at first sight. Well, I looked at him, he looked like a giant. Back to type. So it took a while. But he would not leave me alone. He kept saying, well, can I do this and can I do that? And he would say, I'll get you a room. You want a room here? You can have this room. No, he actually wanted to talk to me. So eventually we went out to dinner. Eventually I said, well, I'm going back to Atlanta. The conference is over. He said, you are? How are you going? I said, well, we need to drive. He said, I have a car. So he wanted to make sure I didn't leave Nashville before he got a lot of my attention. Went to Atlanta, and I had just learned how to play chess. I thought that was very exciting. So I said, you want to play chess? What I didn't know is this man had been in prison for 9 years. He was an expert in chess. I didn't know that. So I sit down and we play a game, and I win. Either he was fast asleep or he did it on purpose. Anyway, so after I beat him in chess, we developed a wonderful relationship, ended up getting married, having kids, traveling around the world.
Okay. This is great. One of the things that, I mean, you were the first woman on the Central Committee of the Black Panthers.
Well, yes, the Central Committee of the Black Panther Party was created in the apartment Eldridge and I lived in San Francisco. And I was the person who would send out the press releases because I could type and I'd notify the press. And so I was kind of a spokesperson. Eldridge was a minister of information. And so when the meeting was in our apartment, I became part of the Central Committee. Now, if I wasn't in that apartment, maybe I wouldn't have become a member of the Central Committee.
Can you say a few words about what it was like to be a woman in the party? I mean, there are strong women in the party, but you were also
surrounded
by
strong women. Well, one of the things you have to understand, in the black community, women are the stronger. Mm-hmm. Women have more independence.
Yeah.
Because the larger white society thinks women are inferiors. So obviously, if you're a woman and you're black, you're doubly inferior. Well, that's not true in our community. Yeah. We are the leaders because we have more freedom and more education in many cases, at least when I was growing up, than men did. And so women were not perceived as a threat.
Right.
Men were. And so we could do things that men couldn't, and men knew it. And we could help them do things. And so the Black Panther Party was intriguing in that it seems like, because it's an armed organization, it's very bold, that it would be very male. But what happened is the males got arrested over and over and over, and it ended up being a woman's organization for most part.
Yeah. Was there a thought within the organization that the revolution, in some sense, couldn't take place without a revolution in the relation between the sexes? I mean,
we weren't particularly worried about the relationship between the sexes. We were really worried about the relationship between the police and the black community.
Okay.
And the black community was being attacked very viciously, and most of the people shot and most of the people arrested were men.
Yeah.
They didn't think women were important enough to arrest for the most part. Yeah. So that gave us the advantage of being able to mobilize. And at one point, the Black Panther Party, I'd say the vast majority, easily 80% of the men either were shot or arrested or run out. And so it became actually a woman's organization.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I want to ask you about the 10-point plan.
Okay.
Because I really, you know, we've been having discussions about the role and place of planning within political work. One of the things that I noticed when I was reviewing the Vietnam plan again today, this is the plan that the Black Panthers set out, a series of protocols.
Do we have anything we could show the 10-point plan?
In the book. The book, if you've already gotten one of the books, it has a 10-point plan. But what happens is they lay out 10 points, and then it closes with a citation of two paragraphs in the Declaration of Independence. Mm-hmm. And this is kind of smart. I really liked this, because then there's an identification between the revolution that is being called forth by the Black Panthers and the American Revolution. And I was remembering Frederick Douglass's 1852 speech on the meaning of the 4th of July for the Negro. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that he does there, where he's talking about the way in which this day of celebration for whites is a day of mourning for blacks, because it's a day that marks not independence for blacks, but the fact that they have not yet gained the right to represent themselves, etc. But one of the things he argues, which is really kind of extraordinary, is that the black slave is the true heir of the American Revolution. Right? And so that this identification between the Black Revolution, the liberation movement, and the American Revolution is a kind of really smart move. And it suggests that in some way the revolution that was supposed to be there, the very first revolution, has been incomplete until it gets realized later, that you can't have that revolution be successful unless blacks are also liberated. So can you say something about the... I mean, I don't even know, for example, how the 10-point plan was put together. There were discussions, people worked on it together, it was a collaboration.
I believe it was put together by Bobby Seale and mm-hmm. Huey Newton in their conceiving an organization. They didn't have an organization. It was two men who wanted to generate an organization. Point one, we want power to determine the destiny of our own black community. This is not original. This is something that's generated over a couple of generations. Mm-hmm. And so we were trying to summarize the basic goals and desires of the larger black community. Mm-hmm. And I think it was done by Bobby Seale, who was a veteran and parent, and he was older than most of the people who became members of the Black Panther Party. He was married, he had a son, he was a musician. And then Huey Newton was a law student. And they were friends, but they were also very, very independent, thoughtful. There's some brilliance in there mm-hmm. somewhere. Mm-hmm. And they were in California. And why is that important? Because first of all, California, it was legal to carry guns. California was far from Mississippi. It was mm-hmm. many people migrated mm-hmm. from Georgia, Mississippi, Alabama, went to California. And so it was a sense of liberation by comparison with the South. That you could do things, you could say things, we could have demonstrations, we could sort of be very dramatic. You couldn't do that in Alabama. I remember talking to David Hilliard, and I said, we were in Montgomery, we could not be having demonstrations in the front steps of the courthouse. Yeah. You just wouldn't be allowed to do it. So the fact that California was so, it was so late in coming into the United States, and the black population in California was very small compared to the black population, let's say, in Mississippi or Alabama. And so the segregation didn't really have a big role in California as mm-hmm. it did in Alabama. And so there was a sense of possibility, which we took full advantage of.
That's nice. Yeah. I mean, part of it is also that the protocols are there both for the black community, but also to transform American society in general, right? Because you can't, it seemed like it was a double project, which gets marked in this plans with the citation from the Declaration.
Well, our basic principle was power to the people.
Right.
People is generic. It's not only black people, only white people. It's all the people. So this was kind of distinctive, I think, at that time, because most of the organizations that were predominantly black were very focusing on what was wrong and what had happened to black people. Now, we did focus on that, but that was not the only issue. The issue was how to change the country, how to change the way people thought. Power to the people. That's very simple. Very, very difficult to realize, but we wouldn't give up on that. I mean, we're still for power to the people, right? All power to all the people.
I mean, this is also one of the things that was, I mean, I think except for the Urban League, who did some of this, the Black Panthers were the ones who would focus on questions of class in a way that many people were not talking about class.
Well, because they're intimidated by that. Yeah. That and also, there was a time when communists and socialists were arrested and sent to jail and denounced. And so discouraged some black people from being part of a movement that seemed mm-hmm. to be socialistic.
Right.
So We talked about black power. We were fairly socialistic, but we didn't emphasize it in the same way.
Yeah.
We were very much focused on putting an end, at least putting some stop to the level of police brutality in California and then in other parts of the country. I mean, we're black people just targets. Philadelphia was one of the absolute worst, with Rizzo, the demon Nazi chief of police. Yeah, so to have a Black Panther Party in Philadelphia was absolutely amazing.
Right. I mean, one of the things that there were many things, of course, that the Black Panthers were right about. They were just, I mean, right about almost everything, right? So, but there's an interview that you gave, I can't remember when, where you say, yeah, we were right, but it's not sufficient to be right.
You got that
right. So there was a, you know, and so that you have to have institutional, corporate, financial, even military support in some way. That there has to be some kind of coordination with all sorts of things, including, of course, education. And so one of the things that's nice about the film is it documents all the things that the Black Panthers were doing: the free breakfast programs, the medical clinics, the self-defense training, the education programs. And I was wondering if you could say maybe a little more about that, because there's something I think that's linked to this effort to broaden the struggle, to see that the success of the struggle depends on it, its expansion across different elements of society.
Right? Well, the Black Panther Party started out with a platform. It had a goal. Right. It had a series of points, and one of them, point seven, I believe, was we wanted an immediate end to police brutality and brutalization of black people. We got kind of hung up on that one.
Right.
You know, we still want that, but it hasn't quite material. But that was the most of the members of the Black Panther Party were teenagers.
Yeah.
19, 18, 17, 16. In fact, one of them told me, well, Kathleen, you're 21. You could be a leader. So we were energetic. We were, of course, since we were young, we were naive. We were very optimistic. It was during the Vietnam War in which the United States was being defeated. So we didn't really think that we would be totally annihilated, that it was an opening. And there were many men, young men, coming back from Vietnam who were trained, and some of them joined the Black Panther Party. Some of them became leaders of the Black Panther Party. Bobby Seale had been in the military before the Vietnam War. So the fact that the country was on a war footing and racial hostility was at a high point, and California was, how would I put it? California was not Mississippi. It was not Alabama. It was not Georgia. It was not as backwards as those places. And many people from other parts of the South had left and migrated to California, particularly coming from Louisiana and the west of the Mississippi. So you had a black population that was more educated and more, how would I say, more hopeful in a certain sense. Mm-hmm. I remember having a conversation with David Hilliard. We were standing on the courthouse steps, and I said, David, now you know, if we were in Montgomery, we could not be having demonstrations to free a black political prisoner on the steps of the courthouse in Montgomery. Yeah, it just wouldn't even happen. Yeah. It wouldn't even occur to anybody to think of doing that. Yeah. So California was more open to people who had been living in the highly segregated South, and many people had migrated, and it was just a, what's the right word, exuberant. Yeah. It was an exuberant moment. That we realized we could organize, we could protest, we could demonstrate, we could put out a newspaper, we could call press conferences, people would come. It was very, very exciting. Mm-hmm. And the fact that that mobilized, the party came into existence as an organization. The leader of the party, Huey Newton, Minister of Defense, there were two leaders, Bobby Seale, who was the chairman, and Huey Newton was the Minister of Defense. When he got shot in an encounter with the Oakland police, and the Oakland policeman who was encountering him ended up dead. It became a very highly publicized and highly charged situation that we mobilized around. And basically the Black Panther Party became a body, you know, a larger number of people because of that incident. Mm-hmm. And we did a lot of demonstrations. We got a lot of, this is California, it's always sunny. And you can get TV coverage for almost anything. And that was my job, to call up the press conferences and denounce things. Mm-hmm. And so we got a lot of attention And some of the attention we got inspired other people to be like the Panthers. And so, well, and then the people started just starting Panther parties wherever they lived. Mm-hmm. And said, yeah, we're the Black Panther Party in Chicago. We're the Black Panther Party in, it was not Montgomery. They didn't get one. it was mostly Western and then Eastern, you know, bigger cities. But it was something, the generation of young people who became Panthers. There was others who were in other organizations. It was I was in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which was mostly in the South. But there was a what do you call it? A sense of possibility.
Yeah.
That we could do stuff. We could make a change, and that was our goal. We want to change the world. We were so young. We actually believed it.
Yeah.
You know that you could change the world.
Yeah. I mean, I remember actually once in the early '90s, I was invited to give a talk in Southern California at a conference called Terminals on the Cultural Production of Death. And Fred Moten was there, I was there, and then somebody gave a talk and they said they had taken a walk in the morning along the beach and they had realized why the organizers of the conference had to import people from the East Coast to come and talk about death in California. I want to return to the issue of education, because I one of the things that I registered this time when I was going through, when I was seeing the film now, reminded me of something that happened in December 2017. Angela Davis actually gave a talk in Greece. And one of the things that she did during the talk, which I really appreciated, is aside from saying that the things that we do to address issues in the present, but we also do it for the future. That we may never even ever see the fruits of our labor. It comes in the future. But she kept throughout the talk, she would say, well, you know, the best essay on this is this. Or this is where we should really look at Marx when he says this. Mm-hmm. Or the best book on this is this. Mm-hmm. And so it became really clear very quickly that her activism was not separable from a labor of reading. And this sort of gorgeous moment in the film in the bookstore, where you have this amazing collection of books, which is there, and there is this educational project that's part of the Black Panther project. And I was wondering if you could maybe say something about the role of books in your life.
Well, more important was the newspaper.
The newspaper, okay.
Newspaper, as far as the Black Panther Party,
yeah.
To communicate. I think the first one was 8 pages because there's a certain format that you can use. And I remember Eldridge's apartment was where the Black Panther newspaper was laid out. He was on the staff of a magazine, so he had access to typewriters and other equipment that we didn't have. Emory Douglas was his best friend and lived down the street. He was an amazing artist. So he would draw, there was a billboard in San Francisco, and the Black Panther Party office was in Oakland, and so those of us who lived in San Francisco would drive across the bay to go to Oakland to the office and then come back, and you'd always see this billboard that said, support your local police. And so Emory Douglas did a drawing for our first newspaper, and the drawing was a pig, just a regular pig. He didn't have any clothes or anything. And underneath it said, support your local police. So the police are depicted as just pigs, but not by verbally. And then eventually the pigs got uniforms, and they got hats, and they got badges, and you know, he had very elaborate drawings of police, and there's nothing they could do.
Yeah.
I mean, they were mortified, but well, how are you going to attack somebody who's doing cartoons of you?
Right.
So the newspaper became very popular. In fact, the newspaper became a national publication and financed the Black Panther Party newspaper sales. But there was a level of imagination, exuberance, and because of the Vietnam War, because of the people who were coming back, because of the people who were opposed to it, because of that tension in the country, our voices and the things we said were receptive. And there were men coming back from Vietnam. They took teenagers to Vietnam, and so they'd come back, early 20s, maybe the ones who got to come back, and they were very attracted to the Black Panther Party. That doesn't necessarily mean they joined it, but there was this element in the community that leapt to be able to, you know, like, we have this opportunity. There's something we can do. We didn't have any trouble getting members. We had more trouble making an organized event. And the party spread across the country, but it went so quickly that the FBI was alarmed, and they did everything they could to make to try, but they had to catch up to infiltrate and destabilize the party. Mm-hmm. So the very early months of it was very exciting. And after a while, I remember we were at a demonstration in Oakland, and Eldridge looked around and he said, "There's all these strange people here. I don't get it. Who are they?" Yeah. Well, there were all kinds of people, and some of them were just paid to come and disrupt our organization. Yeah. Others were curious, but the discipline and the concentration of the organization was sabotaged and undermined.
Mm-hmm. Mm. George Jackson comes up a number of times in the film, and you know, the prison letters that he wrote under the title of The Soledad Brother, very beautiful collection of letters. There's an amazing passage in one of the letters that he writes to Angela, and at one point, he's talking about the middle passage, and at one point he says, "My recall is nearly perfect. Time has faded nothing. I remember the very first kidnap. I've lain in the I've lived through the passage, I've died in the passage, I've lain in the unmarked shallow graves of the millions of corpses that fertilize the American soil, cotton and corn growing out of my chest under the third, the fourth, the tenth, the hundredth generation." And it is a kind of extraordinary passage, and it's a passage, I mean, aside from suggesting the sort of the fertilizer that blacks have become in America and sort of feeding the soil of the soil, the landscape and so on, there's a kind of unusual thing that happens at the end of the passage where he actually went to the third, the fourth, the tenth, the hundredth generation. It's a biblical allusion. Mm-hmm. And it was always my understanding that the Black Panthers had a kind of ambivalence toward the Bible because it was assimilationist. And I guess what I'm really trying to see if you might say a few words about the relation between the Black Panthers and religion, the church, etc., especially given that Malcolm X wanted the revolution to be secular, wanted it to be political, wanted it to be revolutionary. I just wonder if you could say, because there are
some
references.
We agree with Malcolm X.
Yes, okay, good. This is what I mean. But this is what I mean. So it was a kind of strange passage. I was wondering, there are signals in the film about the secularism. But I was just wondering if it was something that was thematized, it was talked about, especially given the importance of the Black church.
Bobby Seale made a point. He said, listen, his mother, and I think maybe his sister, were very religious. He wasn't. Most Black communities, there's a strong church-going population. Yeah, yeah. And even if you don't go to church, in my family, my mother was a choir director and brought up, she was a preacher's daughter, brought up in church. My father was a sociologist and he was probably an atheist. Anyway, he'd go to church and fall asleep. He could care less.
Yeah.
So this is your community, but the church is very significant in Black communities. There was one Panther I remember, I didn't know this until she told me, but she was a sister, I think she went to San Francisco State, I'm not sure. Anyway, she'd be a Panther during the week, and then on Sunday she'd go play the piano for her church. She didn't want us to know. And so, the Black Panther Party were, for the most part, teenagers. Mm-hmm. We have one member, Chairman Brothers in New York, who was a military veteran. Yeah. He was 50 years old. Yeah. He was the only person over 30, I think, in the party. Well, Eldridge Cleaver was old because he'd been in prison 9 years, but he was not old. He was not like other 32-year-old people. Yeah. He was really like the teenagers in the Black Panther Party, which I didn't know. I mean, it didn't occur to me you could be 32-year-old, 6'2", and have written a book and still be a teenager. No. But it was a party full of enthusiasm, optimism, and belief that we could actually make a difference. We said, we want to change the world. We want to change the world. It was kind of aspirational. I remember giving a talk at University of Chicago, and I was saying, we wanted to change the world. And I said, and this woman came up after me, and she said, well, you actually did.
Yeah.
So I was very taken by that. I thought we just kept wanting to do it, but the world wasn't changing enough.
Yeah. Yeah.
But we did change a lot of attitudes. So do we have a chance to do Q&A?
Yeah, I was just going to ask, I'm going to bring Aristides up in a bit. I was just going to, this is before he comes up, he should come up as I'm doing this. Could you tell us a little bit about your decision to become a lawyer?
Yes, I can tell you a lot about it. The Black Panther Party had an attorney named Charles Gary. Now, I didn't really know much about law. I was a college dropout. I knew something about organizing, but I wasn't that familiar with law. But I'm in a movement in which Huey Newton was arrested, and over and over, other people got arrested. Eldridge Cleaver had been in prison. So I became interested in, you know, what is this and how do you get people out of prison? And I saw this attorney named Charles Gary, who was absolutely brilliant. I didn't realize that he was far different to most attorneys. So this is the attorney I'm observing. He was Armenian by ancestry. His other brothers, they were Garabedian, but he changed his name, Gary. And he was one of the best lawyers in San Francisco Bay Area, and the Black Panther Party hired him to defend the case of Huey Newton, in which a black man had been injured, Huey Newton, and the white policeman had died in a battle that happened at 4 o'clock in the morning. So when we went out, I remember going out in a sound truck telling people, come down to the courthouse, see about Huey, see about Huey. And these ladies leaned out and said, he's going to the gas chamber. You know, this is the case closed, you know, black man, policeman dead. Mm-mm. So we were so young, we didn't accept it, we didn't believe it, and we were going to make sure he didn't go to the gas chamber.
Yeah.
He didn't go to the gas chamber. He ended up going to prison, but not to the gas chamber.
Right.
And that intensity sort of fueled the party. It became a national and international organization. And unfortunately, I think it put a lot of stress and attention on Huey Newton as an individual that was a little bit more than he could take. Mm-hmm. Who could take that? I mean, really. So.
Okay. We have Aristides Baltas. And the reason we invited him to be here, too, is because you have this film that gives a kind of international Swedish perspective on the Black Panthers. And we thought that you might be able to say something about the role and place of the Panthers in the imaginary of the Greek left. Because actually the film covers 67 to 75, 67 to 74 are the years of the Greek dictatorship. So it's almost the exact same period. And also, I thought it would be nice if the two of you met.
I think so. Thank you. Yes, thank you.
67, yes, it was the year where the dictatorship, military dictatorship, happened in Greece. 1974, the dictatorship fell. 1973, there was a big uprising of the students of the National University, Technical University in Athens. These are dates which are very coincident.
Yeah.
But I think what you said about being hopeful, we are changing the future, etc., was a worldwide feeling at the time. You could talk to anybody in any part of the world practically. Everybody would know what was happening in the States, in Brazil, in Greece, in Italy, or wherever. They felt immediately the comradeship between the different experiences, and they were very eager to learn from one another what was happening, what was the specific conditions, how did you go about doing this which we admired, things like that. Mm-hmm. Now, in respect to the Black Panthers particularly, I think the whole movement that you described and as we saw played a very important role, so to speak. We didn't at the time have in Greece the question of racism. It was not a big issue within Greece, I mean. Very well understand what you were suffering here. What was more important, so to speak, internationally was, of course, the Vietnam War. And once we started seeing that the civil rights movement started to converge with the anti-war view movement, for us this was kind of, the day before the revolution.
Mm-hmm.
And if we have a revolution in the United States, we have everywhere, hopefully. Now, in this kind of context, I think, we watched very closely the differences between the Black Panther movement, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, why people were talking that way or rather that way, what were the strategies, etc. And I think, I'm not saying this before you are here, but I think that closest to the way of thinking in Greece was the Black Panther Party, and I will tell you why. Mm-hmm. It was a kind, it was, I mean, the very notion of party, the idea of having an agenda starting from free breakfasts to organizing the community in the ghettos, I mean, teaching students, having people learn reading, and of course preparing for the guns, because mm-hmm. it was not up, I mean, you did not want to use the guns to attack somebody, of course, through self-defense, and it was important to have self-defense in that respect. So having this as a party organization was quite close to the traditions of the Greek left. Because during the occupation, the German occupation, when a huge resistance movement started, it started from feeding the people, as a matter of fact. I mean, the Communist Party at the time started to become big because it said there's a huge problem here of famine. So let's start trying to organize people how to eat. And even now, during the crisis, there's analogies, because all kinds of, let's say, popular cuisines, popular, so to speak, hospitals, pharmacies, etc., grew up spontaneously in order to counter the crisis. And that's how the Greek society survived, as a matter of fact, during the crisis, because we lost about 25% of the national income, and the rate of unemployment was something like 30% in the general population, 60% in the younger population. So it was a total disaster. And if there were not these kinds of movements, which were very close to what the Black Party did, wouldn't be here anymore. And I think also because we participated, I mean, talking more particularly about the party series now, because we participated in these kinds of initiatives very early, that we got elected in power, which probably you could have done if the police was not that brutal. And it was brutal because they understood very well the danger you represented. I mean, organizing the ghettos politically, ideologically, the newspaper, as Lenin said, I mean, the big thing is the newspaper, and having spread that all over the United States, and people coming from Chicago and say, I'm a Black Panther member, and then you should check out whether he really or she really is or not. I mean, this is a kind of thing which never had happened in the United States before, much more important than the Communist Party in the United States, and therefore you were the real danger. That's why they decimated us, Black Panthers.
I mean, this last point is an interesting question, I mean, in the sense that what if the Black Panthers had won, right? You know, because this is effectively almost what happened in Greece.
Well, let's put it, let's
no,
put
I
it
mean,
this way.
No, I mean, won it as a party and took over the government.
You have to look at the numbers. There's, I'd like to say, 10 times more white people than black people. So the fact that we had the power that we did and that it was because of the condition and the way that people in the black community could articulate what social problems were, and they weren't just black problems. Yeah. They were our problems, but they were social problems. And so there were issues of hunger and issues of discrimination and issues of not being able to get to education and issues of being brutalized. That's not only black people. So when we talk about it, that resonates with some other people. It was just somewhat unusual that black teenagers are articulating a program for the entire United States. That was pretty amazing.
That's the good thing. That's the good thing.
No, and I only mentioned because, you know, Syriza had like, what, 3-6% in general, and it was only after this sequence that it took over the government.
True. So.
Well, that's fabulous, but your country's a little smaller.
Within
That's true.
Yes, within 2 years. I mean, never hoped that this small party, which was very democratic, very left, very open to solidarity around the world, with many intellectuals, I mean, had a kind of hearing in society, had only 3%, 3-4% in national elections. And within 2 years during the crisis, from 3% we came to government.
That's amazing.
Amazing, isn't it?
It is amazing. That means that people were very, very upset with what was happening.
Precisely, because of the crisis.
Yes.
That's
and
why you represent
country.
The real danger.
It is a small country.
Let's open it up. Yeah.
Could you stand up?
Oh, I think they're going to give you a mic, yes. Hi.
Hey. Okay. So my question is, how do you feel about the extreme gentrification in Oakland and Harlem, in these cities that were essential for the Black Power movement? And are there any things that you think that we can do to counterbalance it?
Well, it's already done, that gentrification, and the people who were moved out of the gentrification already moved out. I think the, what do you call it, the, well, just the domination of money is what we're looking at, and the disregard of people, human people, ordinary people, Black people, children. It's capitalism. It's a runaway capitalism. And so there's a lot of money being made, and therefore, like, okay, when Bill Clinton left the White House, he went to Harlem, got his office in a building in Harlem. And I said, wow, what's that signal? This is like a power move. That Harlem was going to be basically, as Black people in Harlem knew, taken over. Yeah. I mean, I was in a state of shock. How can that be? Well, it's a done deal. Real estate, money, lack of political power, collaborate. You know, so the concept that the Black Panther Party was working on, which was power to the people, didn't take root powerfully enough and didn't have the strength to, how would I put it, hold back the power of capital. So capitalism and racism are still in the saddle. It's not as bad as it used to be, but it's still, we're still exploited and oppressed and set aside. Even though there was a Black man in the White House, even though we had Obama in the White House, we're still, you know, kicked to the curb.
What should those displaced people try to do? I don't know, just rebuild or organize
that? Well, they probably have several alternatives. Some people say, we need more education. Some people give up. People say, I want to go live in another country. Let me go to Africa. Let me go to South America, whatever. Clearly, the goals of social justice and political power and transformation that these small movements represented were popular but not implemented. So this is your generation. It's on you. You know, continue the struggle. There's somebody way at the back.
Yeah,
can you stand up?
They're going to get a mic
I
right
see.
Now.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you get a mic.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, thank you. Good evening. My name is Asantewaa Nkrumah-Ture. Dr. Cleaver, you and I have met several times
over
the years.
Yes, I recognize your name.
How are you?
Fine.
Two quick questions. Do you remember Gwendolyn Simmons?
Yes, very well.
Okay. So could you talk a little bit about how she created a anti-sexual harassment policy for SNCC that set
No, I wasn't there at that time.
You weren't there?
No, I was. When I was in SNCC, the policy was like Black Power, advocating for Black Power, trying to keep the building, how do you say, keep the lights on in the building because of the call for Black Power. The vast majority of financial support for Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee dropped. And so we had no salaries. The only thing we really had that the organization could pay for was electricity, and we had to hitchhike to work. So the financial base of SNCC collapsed.
Okay. Well, I was just wondering if you were around her when she created that policy, because it set a standard for the rest of the civil rights movement in terms of how those things are handled.
What years are you talking about?
I think that was 64, 5, 6.
Okay, I came into SNCC in 66 or 67 and then moved to California. So I was on the periphery of that. I think it happened by the time I was moving to California. Mm-hmm. I got to know her many years later.
Okay, another quick question. The Black Panther Party and its role in helping to create the original Rainbow Coalition with the Young Patriots Organization and the Young Lords Party.
Well, the Rainbow Coalition was a concept that we used because the Black Panther Party was a Black organization. The Brown Berets was a Chicano organization. There was an Asian group called Iwar Kun that was mostly Chinese on the East West Coast. And then in New York, they had the Young Lords, who are mostly a Puerto Rican organization, but not entirely. I mean, there's some overlap. Puerto Ricans could be in the Black Panther Party, and Black people could be in the Young Lords. So this mobilization in different structures with similar ideals was what was so dynamic, I think. And so some people, like Denise Oliver, were in two organizations. Some people were in three organizations. I was just in one, the Black Panther Party, so that was enough.
Right here?
This man here?
Oh, yeah, but we're giving you the mic. Okay, yeah, yeah.
I thought he was going to stand up.
No.
Yes, ma'am. So when it comes down to...
Actually, you ought to turn around so people can see you.
So when it comes down to sustainable resources to the community, so you're providing free breakfasts and different things like that for the community. If we were to provide things of that nature to different urban areas, how does one sustain it if nobody is, like, in a socialistic type of mindset, how do you keep it sustained
so that
you have enough resources to supply to everybody?
Wait a minute, you said socialistic. That's a Black community mindset. The people ought to eat. I mean, it's not socialistic per se, ideologically. It may be, but the notion of free breakfast, Bobby Seale's attitude was, listen, they say our children aren't learning. If they're hungry, they go to school. They're more concerned about hunger than learning. So why don't we feed children and then they'll learn? Now, is that socialistic? Is that common sense? Is that Black community? I mean, it's all of that. So that's what I was trying to get at. These are fundamental, basic, common sense ideas of serving the community, preventing exploitation, in the biggest sense, stopping racism. And our real focus had been police brutality. But when you get to breakfast for children, it really is community development. Yeah. And so I think that's where we're... that's part of... At least when I was growing up, that was part of the way Black communities thought. But then Black communities were tied to churches. And churches had breakfasts, and churches had outreach, et cetera. I don't think that's the case anymore. Somehow or other, it's gotten much more, secular and competitive in Black communities. So
is there...
I'm sorry, did somebody said something?
No, so obviously we lost that village and that connection.
I see.
The community of keeping each other... Yeah.
The main thrust of the question was, how does one in my generation sustain the same mindset within a community that you guys had back during that time?
Well, how did we do it? We would have meetings. We would write a newspaper. We would have rallies. We'd find a way to pull people together and do things. Like, for example, the children's breakfast. It's like, okay, well, listen, if children aren't eating, they're not going to do well in school. So this idea of breakfast, part of the idea was to deflect attention of the police on the Black Panthers, you know, so that they won't shoot us for serving breakfast. But to have the concept of serving the community, power to the people, those are the two concepts that we were working with. And how does that implement? How do you implement that? And I just think high school kids and college kids and people in that generation, they have ideas. What they don't have is a vehicle. So somebody has to come up with the vehicle or the idea to start a movement, start an organization. It'll attract people, but most people don't know how to start it. They just know how to join it.
So I would like to piggyback off that question. There's a lot going on in my head. So we have this manifesto, right, that the Black Panther used to help guide
the movement. 10-point platform?
Okay. Yeah, I look at that as like a manifesto, right? And guiding the movement, and I think that's very effective in having some common ground and being able to effectively spread across the country. What are some of the lessons that we can learn from the Black Panther movement so that we don't make those same mistakes? I remember being young.
good question.
As a young girl, my parents were involved in some chapter on the East Coast, and I benefited from a lot of these programs. So reflecting back on that as a child, I'm like, wow, these were great things. Why, you know, what happened there? But we know that it was intentional through the governmental structures of FBI and. Killing members within the Black Panther movement, right, and disabling them. So was that the issue? Was it internally? Again, what can we...
Well, let's put it this way. The head of the FBI was an old white man from Mississippi. His name was J. Edgar Hoover, and he was paranoid, and he was probably mentally deranged. I don't know. But he was a man in charge of infiltrating and destroying the Black Panther Party. He said the Black Panther Party was the most dangerous organization in the United States. Well, he must have been senile, because, I mean, it was a small group of teenagers with a very smaller group. Let's see, Bobby Seale was 32. I think Eldridge Cleaver was 30 or 31. I was 21. Huey Newton was, I think, 28. So Bobby Seale's the only person in the organization over 30. The rest of the people are teenagers. So how could an organization like that threaten the existence of the United States? The man is paranoid and racist. So, but he could cause a lot of problems, and one of the problems he caused was having people infiltrate the organization and having our telephones tapped all the time. And in fact, they were tapped so much, there was a man in San Francisco, I can't remember who he was, but he would listen to, he's an FBI agent, he would listen to the tapes, and he said, "Oh, listen to the Panthers, it's hysterical." You know, the things they said, the jokes we made, etc. So he was the friendly FBI, I guess. He didn't think we were the greatest threat to the internal security of the United States. But you have to realize, if you're, like we were, very assertively proud of being Black, assertively insisting, and this is during the era of Vietnam, that we had the right to defend ourselves, that our communities were suffering and we wanted to do something about it, and we were going to do it, as I think Elder said, ready or not, here we come. And so that was something that had not happened in America. I mean, the NAACP is very polite and they wear suits. Most of the Black organizations want to be seen as respectable. Well, we didn't care about being respectable, really. You know, we wanted to be revolutionaries, we wanted to change the world, and most of the Panthers were teenagers. So, and teenagers believe they live forever. You know? So they're indestructible, right? How many teenagers think they're gonna get shot? Or if they get shot, they think they're gonna recover. So we had this what do you call it? Exaggerated sense of how we could change the world, and we set about trying to do it, and we got arrested over and over and sabotaged over and over. But I think we kind of lit a fire, because people all over the country wanted to be Black Panthers, and that is what stimulated the government to infiltrate it and sabotage it from within.
Do you think that we need to be more politically engaged to counter that?
Maybe pay more attention to who joins your organization. We were very open. We wanted power to the people. We didn't. I don't think we even understood what infiltration and surveillance was about. If you've been in an organization, you know about it. If you've been in the Communist Party, you would be very familiar with that. If you're in high school, you don't even know much about the Communist Party. And so the vast majority of people in the Black Panther Party were the age of people in high school. In fact, one of the women in the party said, "Well, Kathleen, you're 21. You could be a leader."
Good evening. I'm so proud to be here. My name is Carmen Guerrero. I'm a community organizer. I'm across the border in 2000. And I see nothing changes because this is very new for me, knowing what is the black fight in the USA history. And now I live in Norristown, Pennsylvania, very near to here. And I hear the same story as don't go to Norristown because there is a lot of blacks, there is a lot of drugs, there is a lot of murder, and there is nothing changed. But now it's also the same speech through the immigrants, that we are drug dealers, we are, and I see the same things like happen to my new community about drugs, alcoholism, and all the social issues like we have. The good thing, like you answer, is be organizing. Yes. And try to integrate all communities, because the targeting is no use, like you say, black people, white people, brown people, is all the people, and the power is all the people, and that's what we need to be, investigate, organizing, and know one each other, and don't be afraid, still fighting for this issue, like we need to going to win very soon. Thank you.
That's a good plan. That's a good plan. I think one of the key elements is coalition, because the Black Panther Party had black members. The Young Lords Party had Latino members. The Iwarkun had Chinese members, but we wanted all believed the same thing, but we didn't have the same communities. And so what's important is to pull together community organizations or ethnic organizations to collaborate, not to everybody be in one big group, but every organization to come together to form a coalition, and then build trust, and then build ties to the community. Because the Chinese community, for example, in San Francisco, was fairly set apart, particularly from the black community or the white people. But we wanted to collaborate. So we worked with the Chinese groups and the Puerto Rican group. Not Puerto Rican, it's Latino in the West. It's Puerto Rican in the East. Mm-hmm. But and people were so young, you know, that they were, first of all, they were naive in some senses, but they were open to change. Let's say, well, you know, maybe the Chinese had never worked with a particular black group before, but we agreed, you know, the Red Guard and the Black Panthers, we kind of agreed on the same principles, and they kind of took clues from us, we took clues from them. So I think because America is multi-ethnic and multinational, it's important to organize in your own community, but then to reach out to the next one, not to be so exclusive. So I mean, that is important, but I don't think it's emphasized enough, and a lot of people just give up. Well, I don't know any Chinese people. I don't know how to do this, or why would I, you know? And part of it is not seeing a path to be successful. So that requires what we call imagination. Huey Newton said, the imagination is the biggest power that we have. We can imagine the world being different. But if you can't imagine it being different, you're just going to sit down and just say, there's nothing I can do. So we have to get off that and figure out what can be done, because once somebody sees somebody trying something, they maybe say, well, you know, if they tried it, maybe something could happen. So you have to have a sense of confidence and enthusiasm, which is really, really hard in these days with the Trumpster in the White House. Oh, Lord have mercy. But it's necessary.
I think maybe we'll close on that note.
Okay. So hopeful.
But thank you very much for being here, and thank you, Kathleen. Thank you.
Well, I'd just like to tell everybody that there's another Black Panther in the house. Barbara, stand up. Come on, Barbara. Yay, just stand up. All right. There you go.